Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack. Welcome back, listeners. I am your host, Carol Ann Tack. Thanks, as always, for joining me. And for this episode, we are heading right back to Baltimore with Matthew Norman for his fifth book, The Absolutely Charming Charm City Rocks. So listeners, please join me in welcoming back three-time guest of the podcast, the one and only Matthew Norman. Matthew, thank you so much for once again joining me and the listeners on the Top Shelf podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Third time. I'm impressed with myself. That's a lot. Who's the most, do you know? Do you keep track?
I think right now there's a bunch of you that are all at the three mark.
Nice.
So
all right. I'm going to keep writing.
Please. And if you can abide this, I will have you back anytime. And I believe there is a song with that lyric. I'll have you anytime. And I think it's right. Yeah. Stewart, but maybe. I don't know.
I think you're right.
Yeah, look at that. See, your book inspires all of these emotions and thoughts and memories. I took this book, Charm City Rocks, on vacation, and I started chuckling from the very first sentence. And then I went up to the bar to borrow a pencil because I left mine in the room, and the underlining began to the point where the next day, a very nice lady sitting one beach chair over from me asked me what I was reading, which then, of course, my husband said, oh, no, here she goes. You know? But the charming end to my story is almost as nice as the charming ending of Charm City Rocks because she pre-ordered the book. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's Matthew Norman for the win.
I'll take it. Yeah, you're a bookseller out there on the beach. I'm impressed.
Oh, yeah. My poor, long-suffering husband. This is what happens. The minute you ask me, and this book made it very easy to chuckle and read sentences out loud. I love what author Colleen Oakley says about the book. She says, if Davy Jones and Emily Henry had a baby, it would be Charm City Rocks. So I'm going to stop talking and let Matthew Norman tell us all about Charm City Rocks.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. It's my fifth book, and I can honestly say that it is the most fun I've had writing a novel. And even though my wife points out to me that I was just as miserable writing this one as I was the other four, I look back on this one, I think, fondly, because by the time a book comes out, you've already sort of, it's sort of left your life. It's been almost a year or so by the time a book comes out. But when I pitched this book to my editor, Anne, I said, I've written some bittersweet novels. What if I just took the bitter part out and I wrote a sweet novel? And she was on board and she's like, let's do it. And it's the story of a music teacher named Billy Perkins who lives in Baltimore, who has a long-standing crush on the drummer of a long-defunct rock band called Burnt Flowers, and her name is Margot Hammer. And through kind of a funny series of events, they end up meeting in Baltimore together. Billy lives above a record shop called Charm City Rocks, which is where the title comes from. And they meet. And it's the first time I've written a book where my two main characters are single and they meet within the first maybe 15, 20 pages of the book. And the whole book is about will they, won't they, what's going to stop them, who's going to stop them, you know, what obstacles will be in their way. But so it is my first romance. It's my first love story. And so far, so good. It's been out there in the world for a little while and people seem to be enjoying it.
I would say that's an understatement. I mean, People Magazine, it's been burning up on Instagram. Every time I'm on Instagram, I see the cover of the book. So that's pretty impressive stuff out there. And I do want to start with something before we get to the book itself. There are some Easter eggs in this book. And I love that. You do this with your books. I'm always surprised because I never expect that. It's kind of like a wink to the reader. It's not necessarily something that you have to read in order or they don't hinge on each other in any way. It's just that the characters live in the same city. And I love that. Kent Harif did it with his Plain Song series, and Elizabeth Strout does it to some degree. A few authors do it. Talk about bringing these characters along for the ride.
Sure. And it's not necessarily just the Baltimore books, because I've been in a run of my last three books have taken place in Baltimore, but my first two books don't. And I love the idea, you know, like you said, you mentioned some writers that do this, and there are others too. Richard Russo has done it to a lesser extent. And I'm an enormous Richard Russo fan. And I kind of started doing it by accident. I was writing my second novel, and I kind of casually made reference to a character from my first novel who was a famous writer. And his name was Curtis Violet, and he's a character in my first book. And when I was writing the second book, I had the characters casually reference him because they would know who he is, because Curtis Violet was this very, very famous writer. And right when I did it, I was very excited about what I had done. It felt like there was like a little light bulb that went off. And I was like, this is cool. Like the idea that all of these characters exist in the same world, and the world is essentially exactly like this world, except these, you know, fictional people are alive. And I just kind of kept doing it. And I don't necessarily plan it out. It tends to just kind of stumble into it organically. Yeah. Each of the five books, there are little, like you said, Easter eggs that kind of point to others. And I'm also careful not to have it be annoying and something that alienates people who haven't read all the books or read them in order. I'm very careful to just have it be, if you haven't read any other books, it's just another detail.
I like that it's there. From the website that you have a great book discussion guide. It's an excellent book discussion guide. It talks about your inspiration for the book. There's records that you talk about. But regarding the inspiration, for those who haven't read the book, would you share a little bit about what your inspiration was for Charm City Rocks?
Sure. I was really interested in writing about a musician, just musicians in general. And I'm obsessed with music. I love music. I'm always listening to it. But it's probably the only art form that I'm kind of removed from because I have no idea how it's created. I don't play any music. I don't read music at all. And so musicians to me have always felt almost like magicians because I just don't understand how they do what they do. And so I wanted to write about the musician, and I was interested in the way the music industry is right now, in the fact that on our phones, we can access essentially any piece of recorded music from the dawn of recorded music. You know, everything is out there. And I have two young kids, and they're 13 and 11, and I get to watch them experience music for the first songs for the first time that have been a part of my life since I was their age. And a couple years ago, my daughter Caroline got in the car for pickup. You know, I picked her up at school, and she was like, "Daddy, have you ever heard of Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana?" And I was a matter of fact, sweetie, I have, you know, this idea that everything is new again, you know, depending on who you are and what the context is. And I love the idea of a musician who, for all intents and purposes, her career is over, but she sort of gets rediscovered through this idea of nothing being old anymore, everything being new. And that kind of felt like a metaphor for a second chance at a relationship. You know, somebody who had their big, great love of their life in their youth, and now they're in their 40s, they can rediscover that again, and they can have another love of their life. And it felt like a nice, just little metaphor for a second chance at love. And I kind of ran with that, and that's the book.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you ran with that, quote unquote. And as we're talking about music, music is just as much a character as anyone else in this book. And I recently hosted Stephen Rowley for The Celebrants, and his book includes a lot of music of the Carpenters. Now, I grew up with both of my parents constantly listening to music. It was on the radio, in the car, record albums all over the place. So naturally, I fall in love with music, and I start buying 45s with my allowance money 100 years ago, because I am like the Crypt Keeper. And the first 45 I purchased was Blackwater by the Doobie Brothers. And and I distinctly remember. And the next one that I bought was the No-No song by Ringo Starr. My friend's father owned a record store, so we would walk there after school. And in your book, just like in The Celebrants, every time you mentioned a song, I was brought right back to the memory of that song. And I loved that you did that. It was such like incredible nostalgia for me. It was so powerful. It added far more to the experience of reading this book than I ever expected. There's no question there. That's just a comment.
No, it's a good comment, because I think a lot of authors mention songs in their books, but we're sort of stealing from what movies have been doing forever with soundtracks, right? And we've all seen movies and great movie scenes that are made great by a song being played. And if you're writing a book and you have a particular scene, all you have to do is mention the song. You don't have to quote the lyrics. You don't have to get into the whole, you know, that kind of thing. But if you just mention a song that you know people know, songs that have stood the test of time, they're going to start playing that song in their head while they're reading the scene. Because I believe the readers were all putting, we were all playing a movie in our head when we're reading. And we cast it and we direct it. And if you give them a soundtrack, that can be a part of that movie that they're playing in their head.
There's a line in there about Billy and Caleb going to see a Wilco show. And I can't tell you how many Wilco shows I've seen.
Yeah, me too.
I'm one of those. And I'm thinking, oh, I wonder what show that was. Was that in, you know, was that at Radio City? Was that over at the Beacon Theater? Like, I'm starting to go through all of those things. It's just like when my husband and I got married, we compared our ticket stubs and we found out that we were at so many of the same shows. And we go to lots of concerts. We just went to Red Rocks for the first time. So here I am reading your book, living in that space. And it was really such a joy to be able to do that. And I love that almost every page, there's some reference to music, but it never feels overwhelming. It's never. And if there was a song I didn't know, if it was a piece of classical music that I didn't know, I stopped reading and turned it up on my, like you said, listening on your phone. Another reason that I am such a fan is that you give us in all of your books quite a cast of characters. It's almost an ensemble piece, like all of your books. And in this case, yes, Billy is the lead, or, well, since we're talking music, the lead singer, so to speak, and the rest of his supporting characters, the band. You've got Caleb and Margot and Robin and Lawson. Oh my gosh, listeners, Lawson, wait till you read him on the page. And Aaron, they all revolve around Billy. But Billy, on the first page, you say, here's an interesting fact about Billy Perkins. He's happy. Now, as a reader of Matthew Norman books, I immediately started laughing because we can already guess Billy maybe isn't so happy. He maybe thinks he's so happy, but Matt Norman's going to tell us why. Talk about Billy Perkins. He's a great character. I really enjoyed his story.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very nice. You're on to me, though, totally, because saying the first sentence of the book, he's happy, is a total red herring, because of course he's soon to discover that he's not, but, yeah, so my editor, again, Anne Spire, we were having a discussion a while back. I don't know if I was writing this book yet. It might have been one of my previous, but we were talking about, she believes that a book should have a novel should have a thesis statement. And that thesis statement might only exist in the writer's head, but basically everything that happens should tie back to that thesis statement. And I'm not saying this book has a thesis statement, but when I was thinking about Billy, I was like, well, what if he has a thesis statement? What if I'm happy? And so I built his character around this idea that what would a happy person look like in the year 2023, in which nobody is happy and the world is a mess and everything is on fire, right? And hope against hope, despite everything, he clings to the idea that he's happy. And what would that look like? And how would people around him react to that? And would people around him be on to the fact that actually Billy is quite lonely? You know, and so I kind of went from there in building him, but I wanted very much for him to be a likable character who does not necessarily have a dark side. He's not like a double-edged sword character where 75 pages in, you learn about this horrible thing he did once. You know what I'm saying? Right. I wanted a sweet guy. And I dressed him the way a sweet, disarming person would dress. And I really committed to that. And I think the characters around him are often have darker sides, but Billy just simply doesn't. He's just nice.
I also appreciate that you said just a few minutes ago, you said that, you know, the world is on fire. Everybody is just going through. This is the perfect antidote to that. And I actually said to the lady at the beach chair right across from me, I said, listen, this will make you forget just about everything else that's going on. Don't listen. You won't want to turn on Twitter. You won't want to turn on any social. You are going to be just right in this town at this record store. So I agree with that. In all of my travels talking about Charm City Rocks, I did recommend it to a very good friend of mine who also happens to be a librarian. Her name is Lori Fensterstock. And Lori said, I have two questions. First, she wanted me to tell you that Charm City Rocks is such a feel-good story. I loved it. And then she wanted to know, are any of the characters based on people you know? And how did you come up with the name of the band Burnt Flowers?
I will tackle Burnt Flowers first. It was just brainstorming, really, because the band obviously doesn't exist. They're a fictional band. And I didn't even really have a model for them. And I thought a lot about all-female bands. And, you know, they're the Go-Go's and they're the Bangles. But there was not a perfect model, because I wanted Burnt Flowers to be bigger than those two bands that I mentioned, and maybe edgier too, more of a rock band versus an 80s pop band. And so I basically had to make them up from scratch. And so I just brainstormed. And there was a bit of backstory in one of the earlier drafts that I cut about one of the band members used to take a magnifying glass and burn flowers, which they all agreed was like the most goth rock and roll thing ever. I ended up cutting that exposition because it just, you know, whatever, it was just blobbity blob. But I did like that idea. And so Burn Flowers became the name. None of the characters in the book are really based on anyone in particular. I didn't have a model for anyone. I mean, there's nobody specifically that I built anything around. They're all just pretty much made up.
Well, they seem very real on the page. And I think that's what Laurie was speaking to. You're talking about Burnt Flowers as a group. I kept thinking, are they a cross between Hole and the Breeders? Like, I couldn't figure out where they would.
I thought about them too. I thought about both of those bands you said. Hole, I don't believe, was an all-female band. Of course, obviously, yeah, Courtney Love, yeah, you know, yeah, was the face of the band. Right. And Breeders were really cool, but they were sort of, they just didn't blow up in a big way. Which, like, I wanted the band that was really huge and would have gotten progressively huger. Right. You know, I mean, would have been one of those sort of staple bands like U2, REM, whatever, if they had stayed intact, but they only got three albums out. So they just kind of fell into rock lore, you know.
And I believe there might be some merch. Did I see some merch on Instagram with the Burnt Flowers
t-shirt? One t-shirt exists. So I made a Burnt Flowers t-shirt, and the wonderful designers at Random House came up with the band logo based on just me talking about what I thought it might look like. And they came up with it. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be fun if I made a bunch of t-shirts? And so I made a t-shirt. And turns out making t-shirts is incredibly expensive. So it would have cost me like $1,000 to have even just a handful of them to give out at readings or whatever. So maybe I'll do it someday. I don't know. Maybe if this book were to like blow up or something or get made into a movie, I would break out that old design and hand those things out on the street or something. But it's a cool t-shirt.
It is a very cool t-shirt. I will direct listeners to Matthew Norman's Instagram page to find that. If I have anything to say about it, that will become serious merch. Every book purchase, you get a t-shirt. As I've said, it is a damn funny book. It is smart. It is clever. And I think I was on vacation and I texted you about one of the funniest scenes to me. You know, all of your books have a scene that kind of destroys me. If listeners want to find out which scenes for which Matthew Norman books, you can find them on previous podcasts with today's guest. But the scene between Robin and Lawson, I won't give anything away. I felt I was laughing. I was happy. I was joyful. I had some tears. It's a great scene. I know I've asked you this before, but talk about writing humor. I mean this sincerely when I say each book gets better and better at conveying this humor and kindness, and there's no mean-spirited that's going on. I don't know if that's a word, but I'm just going to keep it that way. So I don't know how you do that. You convey it really well on the page.
So thank you. That's very sweet of you to say. A couple of novels in, I don't remember when exactly I came to this realization, but all of my books are villainless novels. And I think that that's sort of an important idea to kind of think about, because once I realized that, I started kind of embracing it. And there are protagonists and antagonists because, you know, stories need those. But there are no bad guys. And I think if you present readers with a bunch of people trying to get through a situation together, and you basically like all of those people, I think that's a very pleasant reading experience. And there are movies and books that have done that, obviously, in the past. And I kind of embrace that. With the humor thing, I think that's just kind of my worldview. And I think part of my personality is I'm the guy that tries to make people laugh once I sense the room getting too serious. You know, like if everyone's stressed out about something, I will try to make everybody laugh. I will try to diffuse the situation. And in real life, that can be a very annoying habit, right? But on the page, it's actually, I think, allows me to write about maybe serious things, failed relationships, failing relationships, broken families, those sort of things that could be kind of maudlin, or you could devolve into melancholy. But if you're being funny and finding the light side of things, I think it just kind of makes that medicine go down a little easier. And I mentioned earlier, one of my all-time favorite writers is Richard Russo. And I've met him a couple of times in fan situations, just like going to readings. It's not like we've like hung out or anything. But I one time got up the nerve to ask him essentially the same question you just asked me about, is the humor intentional? Is it just your worldview? Like, where does it come from? And he said that it's probably just the way he thinks, but more than anything else, it is what allows him to be a serious writer, because he's being serious. He's writing serious works of fiction, but they're also funny at the same time. And I think that makes it very, very readable. Mm-hmm. You know,
he has a new book coming out.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like 2 weeks out. I think it's like July 25th or something, whatever that Tuesday is. Yeah, it's coming up. It's Everybody's Fool, I think it's called. Yeah. I can't wait. I'm getting it for sure.
We'll talk about that maybe next time you come on. And speaking of that, when we met the last time, we were together to talk about All Together Now. And at the time, you were in your studio or your office, and you had a board behind you, and it had some color-coded stickies, I think. There was something behind you, if I remember correctly. Were you in the midst of writing Charm City Rocks? Where does that book start to show up for you?
Yeah, that was Charm City Rocks. That was the plot board that you were looking at over my shoulder. I remember that. That just sits on the wall on my desk, and that's the plot board. That was the plot board for Charm City Rocks. So you didn't realize it, but you were looking at everything, at the plot. That's what I do. With the last three or four books, I've really committed myself to outlining and thinking through the plot before I start writing. And it just makes the writing process much more efficient. Like with my first two books, I just really kind of winged it. And I think those books were fine, but it also took me forever to write them because I went down blind alleys. I cut out tons of pages, whole characters that didn't end up working. But if you think through all that stuff early, you can solve some of those problems before you start writing. So that's what I do. I have a note card for every significant moment or event, and then I line them up chronologically and I kind of stare at it, and then I start writing. And I keep it up the whole time I'm writing, and events might move around, but I pretty much stick pretty close to that. So that's my note card outline.
And I remember trying to get really close to my screen to see, because I could see some, I could just make out some faint lines, and I thought, oh my gosh, I don't even know. I should have taking a picture, because record video. I wanted just to see what was there. Baltimore is also a character in this book, hence the name Charm City of Charm City Rocks. And on page one, I didn't get past page one, but page one was really such a crowd pleaser for me. On page one, you have this line: Billy even loves Baltimore, because there's something thrilling about living in a city that the rest of the country assumes is on the verge of collapse. Yeah. I'm sorry, I tried to say that with a strong voice. It wasn't going to happen. And I love visiting the city through all of the characters in the book. And I was thinking, oh, you know, maybe one day Matt will provide us a map of the city and we can do like a walking tour of all the events that took place in all of his like plot points, walking tour. The Baltimore sticker you mention, it's really funny. Tell us about that. Is that a real bumper sticker? Also, bumper stickers, are they still around, or are they only car magnets now? I don't know.
I don't know if they're stickers. It might be magnets, but that does exist. So there's a bookstore in town called Atomic Books, and I believe they invented that sticker. So it's simply Baltimore : actually, I like it. And it's very self-deprecating. I mean, it's the very definition of self-deprecating, right? And it's funny and sweet, and you see it everywhere here. It's on t-shirts. It's on a lot of cars in town. And you'll see it like right next to like Orioles and Ravens stickers and things like that. But I think that Baltimore is a great city, but it's a city that has a lot of problems. And there are a handful of other cities like that. Every big major city has its problems, but there are people that love this place while also identifying those problems and working to try to solve those problems, and sometimes just throwing their arms up at those problems because they're too big for people to seemingly solve. But it's a great city, and I wanted to kind of be self-deprecating about that. And I think the thing about Baltimore that I've kind of eased into writing about Baltimore, because I'm not from Baltimore. I mean, I've lived here since 2006, but I grew up in the Midwest. And so I I always feel like I'm an outside observer to a place that I've lived for going on almost 20 years now. And so I think that allows me to see it almost through kind of rose-colored glasses sometimes. And when I want to romanticize the city, which I do in this book, I can do that. You know, I think there are many other writers who can write about the dark side of Baltimore much better than I can. And I will let them do that. Right. You know, but I want to write about the things that I love about the city. And if you walk through the part of town, Fells Point, where this book mostly takes place, it's just fantastic. I mean, it's kind of smelly, and it's you might trip over the cobblestone, but it is it's a great part of town. And I recommend if anybody's ever in Baltimore, head to Fells Point. And the record store in the book, Charm City Rocks, is actually based on a record store called the Sound Garden in the exact same location. And it's just the best record store in the country. I absolutely love it.
Okay, so that will be a plot point on the Matthew Norman walking tour.
A walking tour. That'd be fun. I want to do that.
If we can get that to happen. Yeah. If we get your web designer on that. I love all of that. Is there really a pretzel guy?
There is, but there's a pretzel stand down the street a good bit from the real record store. And so I just picked it up and moved it directly across the street from my record store so they could see it from each other. But you have to walk a good 200 yards probably to get to the real one. So while I cling faithfully to a lot of truth, I also make stuff up too and move things around and change names and all stuff like that. Novel stuff, you know.
But listen, if it's part of the walking tour, that you just add extra steps to your 10,000 step goal. So I feel like that's a win for everyone. And that's a reward when you get there with a nice cold beer. I can't see how anyone loses at that.
Absolutely.
And as
Baltimore is very flat too. You can just walk and walk. I'm thinking about this is a good idea.
Yeah. I am still living in this book, and I do go back to reread certain passages when I need a laugh. And these days, as we said, the world presents all sorts of challenges. This is the book I turn to find some balance, and I've recommended it as such when I'm at work in the library and when I'm walking in the supermarket, and everybody says to me, "What are you reading, Carolyn?" So that is what I do. Any books you would like to recommend to listeners?
I've talked to other writers about this, and there's this common problem that happens when a writer is asked what they're reading. It's as if I've never read a book. It's like my mind goes totally blank. It's like if you walk up to somebody and say, "Tell me a joke," they're like, "I have no idea what a joke is." You know, it's tough. And a lot of times I'm reading things that won't be out for like 2 years. Right. Like Allison Larkin is a good friend of mine, and she wrote The People We Keep, which came out a couple of years ago. Her next book, I think, is going to come out in a year and a half or whatever. I'm reading the manuscript right now as one of her early readers, and it's really good. But I really liked Curtis Sittenfeld's newest book, and I'm glad that I read it after I had written Charm City Rocks, because there's a lot of normal person with celebrity kind of vibe to it. I'm glad that I was done with my book when I read it, because I think it would have infiltrated me writing this book. But
it's a great book. Now that Charm City Rocks is out on the shelf, please, listeners, grab a copy at your local library or your local independent bookstore. The tour is in full swing. Where is the best place that readers and listeners can find out about these upcoming events that you may have?
I am as involved with social media as a 46-year-old man can be, I suppose. You know, I'm not like a 13-year-old. I'm not like my kids, but I do not do TikTok, God forbid. Nobody wants to see me dancing. But my handles are essentially the Norman Nation on all of the three big Twitter, Instagram, I think Facebook as well. So find me there. And I post a lot of pictures of my corgi, Eddie, if you're into that. But then the rest is all book stuff. It's the corgi and the book stuff. That's pretty much what I do. So find me there. And thenormannation.com is my website too. And
great, great website. I will point listeners to all of the information there. And the book by Curtis Sittenfeld is Romantic Comedy.
Romantic Comedy.
So anything you can share? I don't see the plot board behind you. Anything you can share about what's next?
I'm in a different house right now. We're in Delaware right now. Okay. So my plot board for the next book is back home in Baltimore, but
safely.
Safely back. And I'm working on another novel. I always am, and I hope to kind of always be until I drop dead. But it's another book where we meet two people very early on, and it's another will they get together kind of story. And it's a little, I think it's probably not as overtly comedic as this book. I think it's more maybe akin to my last book, which is All Together Now, but it's going great. I feel like writing a novel is very much the metaphor I always think about is trying to get a kite off the ground, where it takes a lot of effort and you run with it and you think this is it, and then it crashes and then you do it again and it crashes. But I feel like it's sort of taken flight, and once it takes flight, it's up on its own, and then you just sort of run with it, you know? So I feel like I've reached that stage. So it's going well, and it'll be my first holiday book. It takes place over the holidays, which I'm so excited about. My books have all been very spring and summery. This is going to be a cold weather novel.
I'm very excited to read that, yeah. And hopefully you will be back in this same scenario on this podcast when that book comes out. Of Charm City Rocks, Kirkus says it is full of clever dialogue, unpredictable twists, laugh out loud moments, and heartwarming joy. It is pure fun. As I said, listeners, Charm City Rocks by today's guest, Matthew Norman, is on shelves right now. You guys know what to do. The book is published by Dell. Matthew Norman, thank you so much for joining me again on Top Shelf. I really do hope you will come back for whatever comes next.
Oh, I will be back. I'm going to be back. I think if when I come back for the fifth time, two novels from now, I want some sort of cool jacket, yes, or something to wear. Like SNL gives the Five Timers Club. That's what I want. So in, call it 3 or 4 years from now, I want a jacket.
And maybe a picture of some burnt flowers for everybody who gets the five-time
totally, that's perfect
jacket.
You've rekindled my idea for a burnt flowers t-shirt. I might just spend $1,000 and just start giving those things out. I might do it.
Start a GoFundMe or get one of those what are those things where people solicit money for creative endeavors. I'll chip in for all of that. Listeners, thank you all so much for joining both of us today. Remember to follow Top Shelf wherever you find your podcasts. For the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website at merricklibrary.org. Thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Diane Bondi, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and on to the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf. Thanks again, Matthew. This was such a joy.
Thank you so much for having me. You're right. It was a pleasure.